Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's binary episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. In this episode, we have a heap overflow in curl, a Safari out of bounds write, and a new Linux kernel exploit mitigation by GR Security, which will be some fun to talk about. First, though, we'll jump into the curl heap overflow, and which, to be honest, I struggled a bit to understand as it's a little bit complicated, but Z got a good grasp on it, so I'll let him get into it here.
Yeah, and I will say this one did have a little bit of panicking around it, just because curl announced they've got this high severity vulnerability coming and they announced it like a week ahead of time. So, like, you know, all the blue teamers out there are like, we've got something big in curl happening. It's biggest vuln in a while.
Building up the hype.
Yeah. And in fairness, I think a lot of people kind of felt a little bit anticlimactic about this one, just because of the fact that this is a bug in the SOX 5 proxy functionality, which means if you're not using SOX 5 proxy functionality, you're not vulnerable to this attack. Similarly, if you're using curls like just the command line tool, you're not vulnerable to this attack for a different reason. If you're using the SOX 5 stuff, you're not vulnerable to this attack because of some other mitigating factors in the curl tool itself. So, like, it is a kind of niche number of users, but there absolutely are people that are using SOX 5 with curl. So, it is absolutely a use case. It's there. But it felt like, and the interesting thing about this one is I can't think of another curl attack where the attacker could get code execution on, like, because basically what would happen is, like, the website you were connecting to could attack your curl instance. Like, that's a pretty rare attack to have, a vulnerability to have in that attack surface, where it's that remote side, you connect to a random server, and they can attack and get code execution on your curl. Or, like, on your curl library, I guess, technically. So that's a rare situation, which does raise the severity of this vulnerability, because it is that remote attacker getting it. And that is a novel aspect of this, too, is this is in that kind of rare attack area. So actually getting into the vulnerability, it's somewhat simple, somewhat complex. So SOX 5, I already mentioned, is a fairly simple proxy protocol. It's, in a sense, it's just kind of a dumb protocol. It has command values for if you want to make like a TCP or a UDP connection, or if you just want to listen on a port. Just give it the command number, you give it your destination address and port, and then once that's successfully done, you could just send data and just want to tunnel it over wherever you want. So it lets you proxy arbitrary like TCP or UDP to any destination, making it fairly popular. It's just this lightweight proxy protocol. You can have encryption over this and a bunch of other things. But the functionality where the vulnerability is in the resolver section, I guess, how it's going to resolve the destination IP address. You can either have that done locally, use a local resolver, or you could let the proxy resolve it itself. So if you use the proxy in that initial message where you're sending the destination, instead of sending a IP address, you send in the actual host name and it'll do the DNS lookup and everything on the remote side of that lookup, or on the remote side, does the lookup there, and then curl doesn't need to deal with it. And so that has a host name on that case has a 255 byte limit. And that's basically just due to the SOX 5 protocol. You can't send something bigger than that, which is fair. DNS has like, I forget the exact value. I want to say it's like 248 bytes or something. So like even a DNS lookup can't go beyond 255 bytes. It's a fair limit in the SOX protocol to not support these massive host names. So it has that lookup, or has that limit in this code for the SOX 5 handling, kind of way back in the day when this was originally written. What it would do is if it noticed the host name was larger than 255 bytes, it would just switch the resolver to use the local resolver instead of the remote one. So even if you told curl to use the remote one, it would change that on you, and it would do that silently. And Daniel in this post makes mention, like, he doesn't think that was a good idea. It should not make that change. It should throw an error. That is what they're doing now, is they're throwing an error when they run into this. But he agrees that that's not a good practice to just, like, silently change what the user asks for. Anyway, so getting into the actual bug, it happened while he was porting the old code into kind of newer non-blocking code. And so in order to incorporate kind of non-blocking aspects, so that is not just waiting for everything to end and doing it all sequentially, but letting other things run at the same time. In order to accommodate that, basically wrote the function, added in a state machine or something that's going to track the current state, what it's needing to do. And so kind of the function can execute and go through the states until it can't anymore. So until it doesn't have enough data from the SOX proxy or whatever it's waiting on, whatever blocks it, it can just go and keep executing, hits that, and then it could just, you know, it saves its state and it returns. And then when there's data comes in, or when data comes in, it can just enter that function again, find where it was, and keep executing from there, making it kind of a not, or giving it that non-blocking flow. And in doing that, this little check that would change the type of resolver being used, telling it to use the local one instead of the remote proxy one, that change wouldn't persist. So if it had this code here, where if it's using the, if it's not using the local resolver and the hostname is too long, it would just flip this flag. So that works, but if it needs to exit the function, then come back in, that second time in, it's already done this hostname check, and it didn't actually persist the state change, that flip of which resolver to use. So when it comes back into the function, if it did get blocked, leaves, comes back in, that resolver will be again set to use the remote resolver. And so when it goes to build up the buffer for the actual request to be sent over to the SOX proxy, it's going to copy in that hostname. It thinks all those that size check happened already or happened earlier. So it's going to copy in that host name. If it's bigger than 255 bytes, it's going to overflow the expected area. Now, it is writing this into kind of a larger buffer. It reuses the regular download buffer for this. Or it makes mention that this is the same as the regular download buffer that's being reused in this case or for this purpose before transfer starts. And just kind of building up that protocol frame to send to the proxy. So it's not overflowing a 255 byte field or array or something, like it is much larger. They say the default here for the download buffer is 16 kilobytes, but it can be as small as 1024 bytes, and the curl tool sets the buffer to 100 kilobytes. So your maximum size, or basically your overflow is happening in that year, overflowing 16 kilobyte by default. It would be a 16 kilobyte overflow. And so with that overflow, I guess I should put things together and mention that now. So if you're establishing that connection, you have a web page, you made a request to a web page and it has like a location redirect or location header doing like a 302 or whatever type of redirect. If it provided a host name that was longer than that 255 bytes, along with also blocking, so the function ends up leaving this whole state machine. So if you also have kind of a slow target, I'm not exactly sure on the semantics of how the blocking would need to work from the attacker side, just the fact that you would need that case to happen somehow. It'll basically take this really large location out of that location header. It'll take that really large host name, write it into this buffer, and if you provide something long enough to overflow the buffer, it will overflow the allocate or that download buffer into whatever else is nearby. So legitimate bug, and it's a little bit weird to actually trigger this one or to think about the triggering, because it does have that state machine, that non-blocking aspect where it's entering the same function a couple of times or however many times to actually get something done. And the core bug is just the fact that the state change happened without being persisted. But you are, because the curl tool sets that buffer to 100 kilobytes, and curl will limit just its URL parser itself, so parsing the location from the header, limits it to 65,535 bytes. Because of that, you can't get enough data in the hostname to overflow the buffer when you're using the curl tool, although you would have enough to do the default download buffer size. So yeah, I mean, it's core. It would be a tricky bug to catch with code review. Just reading it and noticing that. Well, it can be a tricky bug. I haven't looked at the curl code to know exactly how it's written. If it's weird that saying a local variable, usually that isn't a very weird thing to see. So yeah, in this case, though, definitely comes.
You got to get into a bit of a weird headspace, right? You got to think of it in like the reentrant nature of it. You got to keep track of things in a way that you typically wouldn't when you're reviewing code. And I guess you kind of can with like globals and whatever, but that reentrant nature of it makes it difficult to keep track of. But it's also what makes it so interesting as a bug. And then the discrepancy between the curl tool and the curl library as it's used in applications adds further complication, because if you're doing automated testing like fuzzing or whatever, you'd catch it in one case and not the other. So there's some interesting factors into this bug that make it, you know, not too surprising that it was hiding sort of for a little while.
Yeah, like other factors that add into that I mentioned earlier, like an actual DNS lookup can't even have a 255 byte name. At least UDP, I haven't looked at how DNS over HTTP works and stuff, if it maybe alleviates some of those size constraints. But I think they talk about it in here. Okay, yeah, it does mention here, DNS only accepts host names of up to 253 bytes. So, like, there is no legitimate case where this bug could be exercised. Because there's no legitimate case where you actually have a DNS entry large enough for that, I guess. Or at least, not that I could think of, and they mentioned here, like, a legitimate name that's longer than 253 bytes is unusual. Okay, they do say unusual, so there may be some. I guess if you use the prefix saying maybe you get an entry that's smaller, I'm not sure. But in a real name, longer than 1,024 is virtually unheard of. So, like, yeah, it would be pretty... As it mentions here, this pretty much requires a malicious actor to feed it that long host name while the SOX proxy is being used, it's in the remote resolver thing, and having that blocking happen so that it re-enters it.
It's not something that's going to trigger in like regular behavior to get caught.
Yeah, it won't get exercised at all on that. It could only be like the fuzzing that maybe gets it. And even the fuzzing, a lot of fuzzing limits the input values, so you don't get these massive inputs. I mean, yeah.
It kind of depends on what's on the context.
Yeah, like you would get large enough inputs, but to decide to put it specifically into that location header of that big feels like at least some fuzzers might not, although I mean there's definitely reasons why it could, so yeah. But yeah, I think in terms of hunting this, like it is just a hard bug to spot. It feels like a pretty subtle bug.
I'd agree, yeah.
I noticed it kind of at the end of the post here, but I didn't actually check out before here, but there is a HackerOne report. I'm just curious if it mentions anything about how they found it. No, I mean, he does walk through the code, so that makes me think they could have been reviewing the code to note it, especially because they seem to go into a lot of detail here, but yeah, it's not explicitly mentioned if, like, fuzzing was used or something. Yeah,
I'm just reading through some of the comments, but I don't see anything obvious.
Yeah, it's a great find. I get why they took note of it and gave that pre-announcement, because it is very rare to see a bug that is where, like, the website you're visiting can attack you against curl. Like, that's not the usual place we see a lot of the attacks come in. A lot of them have to do with how curl is being used on the server side.
Yeah, and highlighting that towards the end, they mentioned that this was actually the largest bug bounty that was paid out in curl. It was a $4,660 bounty, so that's a pretty cool aspect of it as well.
Plus it had the bonus from the internet bug bounty.
Right, yeah, so the additional was, 1165, yeah.
Yeah, so 5,825, I think. But yeah, got a good bounty for it. Well, a fair bounty for it. I guess you could argue that one. I'm sure some people would say it's not enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's more than you'll see from most programs, though, especially through like
open source stuff is like kind of rough, because this is an open source project. Doesn't necessarily have a lot of funding to give out big bounties, even though it is well used. There is also, I don't know how much we want to go into it, but he does have a little bit at the end about talking about, like, you know, yes, this family of flaws would have been impossible had curl been written in a memory-safe language instead of C, but porting it to... I do appreciate kind of the dismissive statement here, but porting curl to another language is not on the agenda. Just leave it at that. there's a little bit of a discussion there. Yes, if you were to port this over to like Rust or rewrite all in Rust, there's even a fair chance Rust would pick up some of the threading stuff, but there's a fair chance that Rust wouldn't even pick up this bug. If you were going for just code by code, line by line translation into Rust, it changes the state value, it didn't persist it. Like, it wouldn't even necessarily pick it up there. You wouldn't get the overflow, but you would still have that core bug. But yeah, I guess the overflow is what matters, so fair enough. I was saying about the core bug still being there, but without the overflow, does it really matter?
I'm thinking of maybe what other potential implications there could, like security implications there could be, but none really come to mind immediately.
I will just mention here that the Open Source Security Podcast, their episode 397, talked about this and the glibc bug we talked about the other week, and got into a discussion about like problems with trying to rewrite everything in Rust, and they have a lot more experience when it comes to like maintaining open source software and like that whole ecosystem. So I would kind of leave it on with them. I disagree with some of their statements regarding AI. Well, they had their own disagreement there, but they go kind of deeper onto that. Like, most of the episode is around that stuff. So if you're interested in that discussion, I'd say check them out.
Yeah, I don't want to reiterate on the Rust discussion too much, because we've talked about it a few times. And yeah, I mean, the reality is, especially something like curl that's so embedded in the ecosystem and whatnot, like, you know, the just rewrite it in Rust, bro, is just kind of a meme. So
yeah,
but he does, you know, there is a little bit of a legitimate discussion that can be had, but yeah, we'll just skip over that.
Well, he calls out here like the replacing it in parts, you know, parts of curl being piecemeal replaced. That's really, I think, for any of these long-standing open source projects, that's really the only way you're going to see a rewrite. Yes, it would be better to use under the language, but you're not going to see this mass rewrite. You're going to see, yeah, I think, kind of like what we're seeing in the Linux kernel.
Exactly.
They get Rust in there, and actually I think Windows is adopting in Rust now too.
I'm not sure if they've gotten it underway yet, but
yeah, but either way, it's like they have the approach to do it piece by piece, you know, really slow, but slowly things maybe get replaced in there, new features end up in there and stuff like that. That's really the only approach I think is feasible with anything like this, and even that is going to be a very slow process.
So we'll get into our next topic here, which is out of security intelligence, actually Valentina or Chompy. And it's a bug in Microsoft's kernel streaming server, which is the driver for virtualizing cameras, such as like a webcam, to allow multiple apps to use it. So as you can imagine, the interface to that is quite an interesting attack surface, and I'll let Z get into it.
Yeah, and the bug itself is pretty simple. It's a type confusion. Effectively, what you've got in this whole camera system is you have a number of ioctals that can be used. Nothing too crazy. You've got like initialize context stream, register context stream, drain, publish, consume. Like nothing too crazy in there for dealing with these streams and either publishing or consuming on it, and obviously initializing. But the way this whole, a lot of these things end up working is when you're creating the new file, it is storing, or sorry, not new file, but when you call one of these initialized context or initialized stream ioctals, it ends up filling in the file object in this fs context 2. Sorry, I'm just trying to highlight it on stream. That fs context 2 fills that in with the pointer to whatever object you just created. So if you create the context, fills in that pointer with that. If you create the stream, fills in the pointer with that. And then when you go to use that in these other things, like with consume or publish, with those other ioctals, it'll look up the pointer provided, see if it exists as like one of the viable. So they talk about here in the publish RX ioctal, it just does this lookup with the stream object and just looks up, is this basically a valid pointer? They dive in to find object where it doesn't differentiate between a stream or a context object. It just looks up, is this pointer a object that I created that I know about? That's all it's looking up.
Well, just to clarify a bit here, so that file object, the way I read it is like the per file,
yes.
But it's just they have the lists of the stream and context objects, and this find object method will look in both lists, so whatever it comes across first is what it'll return, and it can be of two different types, which the design for that seems like ripe for abuse. But that initial FS context is just the context. It's not the stream. But yeah, it's kind of those two different lists where things get confusing.
Yeah, literally for the vulnerability. Like with this look up there, it's not differentiating between the two. So you can end up calling one of these things that expects you to be using a stream and actually be using a context, or you can call something that's expecting a context and actually have provided it a stream, and it just sees as, well, I found the object, so I'm good to go. And that is fundamentally the type confusion that happens, is where you have either the context object or the stream object, and depending on what you end up calling into, you could have your context object treated as a stream object or the opposite. For this bug, they found it more useful to take the context object, which is small by about hex 160 bytes. Since it's smaller, any of those accesses on what would be inbound stream object were out of, or some of those accesses were out of bounds on the context object. Basically, all of this extra area down there is going to be out of bound objects, or out-of-bound data for the actual object.
Yeah, it'll be adjacent objects that you don't have ownership of.
Yeah, or in theory don't have ownership of. Of course, they do talk about a spray strategy here using the data queue entry. Effectively, you have the data queue header on there, so like 10 or 16 bytes, hex 10 bytes that you don't really control, followed by a bunch of bytes that you can control. So as long as you can get that adjacent to your context and you're overflowing into data, you know, just spraying that in the pool. They do end up also having a read primitive here. Talk about the sec shove, no spray and pray. If you try to do the consume TX, instead of providing it the stream, you provide it the context object, or get it using the context object, it'll end up calling a function, I think it was get stats. Yes, get stats gets called, which ultimately just copies some data out of the object, which is out of bounds. So it's copying some of the out of bounds data into the system buffer. So the user gets that back, gets back that out of bounds data, which just makes it easy to know if a spray has landed or what object has actually been sprayed. If you spray several objects, you can determine which object is actually landing there, which kind of gives them a way of checking to make sure the right data is in the right place before they actually use their write primitive. And the write primitive was using the publish Rx. And long story short, it kind of digs through here, but it ends up using a pointer. And basically, they have a arbitrary location, but not a arbitrary value. So they have the value 2 being written out to a location they can control through that out of bounds data, or through the data queue entry that they spray. So that gives them just that write of 2, which can feel like a pretty challenging thing to exploit. Like when you just have that constant write, I think a common way we've seen that kind of exploit is by targeting reference counts. So if you have more than 2 in a ref count, you overwrite it with a 2. And you can maybe get something there because it gets freed early, so you get use that free. And you often use this to introduce another bug. What they were able to do was they were able to use a technique. So this, the technique they used from Yard and Shafir, who did a IO ring. I'm trying to find the link for it now, but for some reason I'm not seeing it in this post anymore. Either way, I also can't seem to type. Either way, they use this IO ring technique. It is something that has been known about. And basically, the gist of it is you have the IO ring object. You can target the registered buffers and the reg buffer count. So reg buffer count kind of makes sense. If it's 0, you're just giving it a non-zero value. So you could write just 2 to it. Whereas the reg buffers is the location where it's going to read the pointers for all the buffers that the IO ring's using. If you use the 2, you can get into user mappable locations. So you can overwrite the pointer to be somewhere that a user could have access to or could be controlling, could map memory to. So they end up doing it, I guess it's not in this post, whooping in the other post, but
in the other post they use like hex 100,000 or something, but in this case you'd use like hex 2.
Yeah, you would
in this case it would be hex 200,000, yeah.
Yeah, so you would overwrite that with 200,000, whatever, just somewhere user can access. And so that gives you the primitive to read and write whatever addresses you put in that regbuffer memory. And you have two buffers because that's what you're overwriting the count with. So you can use those buffers to get your arbitrary read-write. And from there, as is common in kernel exploitation, we have arbitrary read-write. In this case, you can get your security tokens or change out or go basically wherever you want. Like, it's game over once you have read-write.
Yeah, that's the common Windows strategy, is going after the tokens. I did manage to find where in the blog post they link off to the Yard and Shafir posts, as well as another security intelligence post where it was leveraged. It was kind of sandwiched like right in the middle, so that's why it was tricky to find. I don't really think I've seen a fixed write like this used for targeting an address, because I think this is sort of specific to Windows. Generally in Linux or whatever, you can't just confuse a kernel buffer for a user buffer. Like, SMAP's going to be like, no, you can't do this. We're going to blow you up. Whereas in Windows, the line between the user land and kernel memory is a lot more blurred. I think there are some areas that are SMAP'd, but I'm assuming this is not one of them. So it kind of makes way for this technique to work. At least I believe that's what's going on here.
But I think IO Ring does, I think, let you provide user buffers. So I think that could also be why.
For the reg buffer, though? Because
No, that feels like it shouldn't be.
Right? It's confusing the kernel and user mapping. So.
Yeah, no, you're right. I'm not sure. My initial thought was, yeah, you should be provide that. But yeah, that's not that's a pointer to the list of buffers and not the actual buffer. So like, you provide the buffer, you don't, shouldn't get to control the list. Yeah, the SMAP stuff is a good shout. As I understand, there are parts of core Windows that do have it enforced, and it's selective on drivers if they want to. I would have felt like, you know, this being something that's provided by Microsoft, they would have added in there, but I don't know why they wouldn't, but it seems like they don't here.
Or maybe I'm missing something. Like, if we are, like, feel free to comment it or whatever. But I think this is taking advantage of that thing, what I was talking about, where Windows, that line is a bit more blurred. And so you're able to take advantage of that here.
On the whole, I do kind of like seeing these constant write bugs exploited. Because they're a little bit tricky to exploit just in general because you don't control the value. It's always fun to see how people go about it. This is using kind of a known technique, but I don't think we've covered...
We haven't covered too many, like, constant write wares.
Yeah, well, we have covered some. I was actually trying to think if we've covered this read-write primitive or not. Although it looks like it was a summer post 2022, so we probably did not.
But yeah, like, these kinds of constant write where primitives, they require a bit of creativity to exploit. It's not as, like, straightforward or repetitive, I guess, as some of your stronger primitives, like arbitrary write or whatever, where you just target whatever is the meta, like what we were just talking about with Windows, like you would always go after the tokens. It makes the exploit a bit more interesting because there's more clever techniques that are needed. And this IO ring one is cool. And it's a good one to keep in the back pocket, at least until maybe that gets addressed. I don't think Microsoft is as quick to kill techniques as Apple is or whatever, so this might just live on for a while anyway, but it's a cool primitive. I think it might be Windows 11 only, though.
IO Ring is relatively new to Windows.
It's a primitive unique to Windows 11, so that is something to keep in mind as well, is that you're kind of limited in your targets using a technique like this.
Yeah, but it's still a useful technique. Like I said, it's fun to see how these things get exploited. I'm just looking at this post. It looks like this post goes quite detailed into the actual attack beyond my little brief summary. Or I guess the primitive, but yeah.
It's worth noting that there was a little bit of complication in exploiting this bug as well. I won't go too much into it here, partially because there's a fair amount of terminology being used here that I'm not as familiar with, because it's sort of specific to how Windows memory management works. In this publish Rx function, like after they'd get the constant write where, there was this KE set event function that would be called, and the pointer that it would use, this process build pointer, they'd have to make sure that that was valid. That way it wouldn't, crash immediately afterwards. So they talk a little bit about that. We'll shut that out in case you want to read that and get a bit more down on the dirty details of the exploit, but I wanted to call it out, but it's not something that we'll really go into.
Yeah, there's actually a fair bit more that I'm kind of glossing over with this, just because of the fact that if you're not actively doing Windows or like know the Windows kernel stuff, I think it's less applicable. Like if you were to apply this idea elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, as always from Chompy, it's a really nice post. There's some, like, it goes into the RE. Of course, when you're dealing with Windows, you don't get the nice source code that we get typically in a lot of posts. But the RE that's being done here through, I'm pretty sure this is BenjaHLIL, you can understand what's going on here pretty well. Like, everything is named and labeled, and you can follow along. So, yeah, awesome post. So next, we'll get into a Safari vulnerability that was published by ZDI. I don't think we've covered any ZDI posts in a little while now. And yeah, so as I said, bug in Safari, and it's an integer underflow, no less. Pretty rare that you see that in modern browsers. And honestly, this bug is a bit of a unicorn. I thought these kinds of bugs were pretty much extinct for modern browsers. But as is usual with browsers, the issue ultimately involves callbacks. So most of the time with browser bugs, I like to look at the proof of concept first. So for those that are listening and not able to watch, basically the proof of concept will create an array buffer called AB, and it has a length of hex 1,000 elements and sets a max byte length of hex 4,000. It'll then create a uint8 array that is instantiated from that array buffer, and it'll define a callback, really simple. All it does is resize the array buffer to 0 and return 0, and then on the final line, which is the critical line, it'll call copy within, which for those not familiar with what that function does, it'll basically do a shallow copy of elements in an array to another area inside that same array, and it won't change the length of the array. So copy within has two required arguments and an optional third one. It has the target element index to copy to, the source element index to copy from, and then there's an optional argument where you can specify an end index to cease the copying. So the POC will set the destination index to hex 20. That's fine. That's under hex 1,000. That's like everything's good at this point. But then in the second argument, it's doing something a little weird. It's setting the value to a value of property, which invokes that callback that I mentioned earlier that resizes the array buffer to 0. And what's going on there might not be super clear, but in the browser engine, the vuln happens in this generic typed array view proto func copy within function, bit of a mouthful, but that basically implements or helps implement the copy within routine. And again, if you can look at the screen, I would encourage it, as it might be a bit harder to follow audibly. ZDI pastes this function snippet here in relevant code. One of the things the function does is it'll take the length of the array, so hex 1,000, and then it'll initialize the to, from, and final variables, which are essentially the arguments to copy within, the destination index, source index, and end index. And it'll do that with this argument clamped index from start or end function. The problem is on that second argument, the from argument, the array buffer length is changed to 0, which results in the from index ultimately being returned as 0. Now you're in this weird state where the array buffer is 0 sized, but the destination index is still hex 20, which would obviously be out of bounds at this point. Now the developers did think of this scenario, as it's one of the oldest tricks in the book for attacking browsers, is trying to resize the array buffer inside of a callback. So they try to like check for this and clamp it again. So they'll check if the to or from variables, whichever is higher, plus the number of bytes to copy is more than the length. And if it is, it'll try to clamp it down. It'll override the copy length to be the length of the array minus the to or from. The problem is, where the length was set to 0 in this case, it would set the count to 0 minus hex 20, which obviously underflows and then is passed to memmove for the copy length, which is extremely large. So quite a funny bug. Like I said, bugs of this nature in GSC, I haven't really seen many in the last few years. This is like sort of reminiscent of what you see in like 2016 or something. So it's nice to see. I do question the exploitability of this bug though, because this count is a size T. So it's going to be a 64-bit value. And like, as we've seen, like it's hex FFF, FFF, like all the way to E0. It's a huge value. I don't really see an obvious way that you're going to be able to interrupt this mem move. So I mean, of course, with a value so large, you're eventually going to hit either unmapped memory or you're going to corrupt things that are pretty difficult to recover from, which are just going to blow up the browser. And because you're in JavaScript and you don't have true parallelism, like you don't have real threads, I don't think you'd really be able to race getting your exploit off before the browser blows up. So I'm not sure if this would really be exploitable. Maybe there is a way to interrupt that copy before it gets, like, it goes too far, but I can't think of one. I don't see any obvious ones. So yeah, it's a little bit questionable as to whether this is exploitable. With the ZDI posts, we don't tend to get the exploitation details. It mostly just focuses on the bug. But given what I know, like my experience in WebKit and everything here, like I think this would be, unless you had some weird trick that I'm just not aware of, I don't think you would really be able to exploit this.
Yeah, the one thing that kind of comes to mind to me is, like, you do have complete control over to and from, which are also size T values. I'm just not sure if, because they're coming from the JavaScript, if you could provide a sufficient, well, so I guess you need to provide a sufficiently large value, although then you're also going to be clamped by, like, the starter end. It does those checks inside of that clamp function. It feels like you probably couldn't get a large enough value to make that copy small, but that would be the one place I would want to dig into to figure out the exploitability of this. Because they do mention, like, on the Twitter post for this, they do call it a integer underflow remote code execution bug, which makes me think, like, there was a way to exploit this with ZDI. I usually expect them to want exploitation, not just taking a random underflow. Although this person, the reporter here, I believe, does work directly for ZDI, so maybe because of that, they were able to just report it. But, oh no, I feel like it should be, there's probably some way they're managing to exploit this. That would be the one place I'd want to dig into, is like if you could just make the copy smaller somehow. Because, yeah, I don't think you'd be able to race it too well inside of the browser. Or, well, just from the JavaScript, unless you also have like an extension or something. But that's a bit of an ask.
Yeah, and commenting on the ability to control the to and from values. So yeah, like you said, there are 64-bit values internally in the JS engine. What some people don't realize, though, is JavaScript, at least without like extensions or whatever, actually this might have changed recently, but for a while at least, it didn't have support for 64-bit integers. If you wanted to have 64-bit integers, you would have to use some class that would implement like low and high tracking for the individual 32-bit components. So even though the engine may treat it as a 64-bit value, from JavaScript it should be a 32-bit value. So I don't really think that you would be able to leverage your control of to or from to get it to a really small value. But again, maybe I'm missing something, maybe I'm wrong. But yeah, just at the moment with what I know, this would be tricky to exploit, and I'm not sure how it would be exploitable. But the factors you mentioned are worth bringing up as well. You know, I don't want to discount that they're calling it a code execution and just say, oh, they're wrong. But yeah, even though it's kind of a straightforward bug and it's a really nice one, exploitability, it's not as guaranteed or understandable. All right, so with that out of the way, we can get into our last topic here, which is the Linux kernel mitigation I mentioned at the top of the episode. So this is out of GR Security. The mitigation is called Constify, and it aims to make things like function pointer tables or operation tables constant. So the whole idea here is that they're moved into a read-only mapping. The operations tables can be annotated with this mutable const annotation, and then GR Security's modifications to the toolchain will make it so that that's moved into a read-only mapping, and then anywhere in the kernel functions that are supposed to initialize those values will have some instrumentation inserted to temporarily make that mapping writable, so that that write can go through and that it'll close it off again. And it's aimed at preventing hijacking of function pointers for call-oriented programming or COP-style attacks. So it's pretty straightforward in what it does.
I figure we should mention at least like what prompted this was actually in the wild exploit that we talked about on the two episodes ago, I think maybe we had.
I think it was actually the last episode, because we weren't around last week, so
wasn't sure if it was last one or the one before that. But it was that Android in the wild exploit, and what they had there was they basically faked the FOPS structure for this Ash, this AshMem FOP. So that's basically just in C, you don't have like proper, in a sense, object oriented stuff. So using an operation structure is common, where you'll have these common operations. So like read and write and like other things, you'll just have the function pointers as part of the structure. So that's what FOps is it's these file operations, so read, write type things. And basically they just replace the FOps that were, or they crafted their own FOps table and then swapped out the FOps pointer to point to the crafted object. So that was kind of the root attack that led to them thinking, well, could we just make this whole structure constant or constify it and still let the source make changes, but otherwise don't? So I figured that's at least worth some context. And I also want to shout out that when we did talk about this bug, we were talking about the CFI aspect and shouldn't CFI have stopped this? And I had argued that, no, the CFI isn't that granular. I was wrong with that statement. CFI is that granular and may have been able to stop this. I think the reason why it wasn't in this case was because it was still replacing a like read pointer and a write pointer with another object's read pointer and write pointer. So it's still that same signature. But on this one, I just wanted to add that context about the original bug.
Yeah. And the idea there is like you would swap it with gadgets that are useful to you, not necessarily hijacking it to like a ROP chain or whatever. But you would set it to other functions in the kernel that cause some type confusion or whatever that give you a useful primitive. So, yeah, we talked a bit about CFI at the time, which, you know, if it is the signature, then this would add a bit of value over what CFI would have. Because that when I first read through this, I was like, okay, CFI pretty much is designed around preventing this kind of thing already. But if it's a granularity issue, which I'm not 100% sure it is, then this would add a bit of value there. The other thing that this does, they also patch in the randomized layout attributes on various structures to try to make the operations tables harder to assume the structure of. Like if you're an attacker, you would have to know which offset the particular operation you want to swap is at. At least that's the idea. I don't think it would be particularly effective, but I did want to call that out.
It could definitely be effective because it is, it's another sort of randomization where if you don't know what offset something's at, it just takes having that read to read it first to get the offsets.
Yeah, like an attacker in a sufficiently privileged position would be able to defeat that pretty quickly anyway. So it does seem to be prompted by some of the recent posts that show exploitation strategies that leverage corrupting the function pointers. But honestly, I don't think this mitigation would do like that much or is too good. For one thing, it kind of clashes with CFI a little bit because in most cases, Android CFI should be fine-grained enough to prevent these kinds of techniques anyway. I think the Samsung case was sort of a one-off. But also, I think this is pretty weak without any hardware backing or like hypervisor or something. Because if you have sufficient privileges as an attacker to smash file operations pointers, you can also probably just overwrite the page table entries too for the permissions for that carve out and just make it writable again. It barely seems to add a step in the chain to get around this unless there's something I'm missing. And in the cases where a hypervisor or whatever does exist to protect the page tables, which is the case on some mobile devices with things like Samsung's RKP, I think things like this are being done already. So I thought it'd be fun to talk about as I think it's a good example of a mitigation that's well-intentioned, but just doesn't really do a whole lot. It seems kind of weird to see effort being put into these mitigations that just seem to be chasing the recent techniques in this way rather than mitigating the initial primitives in the first place. I feel like trying to mitigate this late in the exploit stage is just a losing game unless you have, like I said, like a hypervisor in place or some higher privilege boundary.
Yeah.
Now, I will say we don't know exactly how this mitigation is implemented because it's closed source, like it's proprietary. They sell this. So how they implement that instrumentation is a little bit up in the air because they say at one point where the current CPU would be allowed write access. And the way I was assuming they were doing the write protection and everything was through PTEs and just having a separate memory region carve out for it. But the way they say current CPU makes me think maybe it's something else. So where I don't know exactly how it's being implemented, I don't have a GR security compiled kernel to be able to reverse it. I'm kind of working off of the assumption that it's going through page tables, in which case an attacker can just smash the PTEs. Like it's not really adding a requirement for another bug or something to get past this.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing, and you mentioned it, where this is such a late stage mitigation, and it feels almost like an old school approach to trying to mitigate bugs by targeting the common techniques that were used, where it's like, yes, it does do a little bit. Like, I will give them that. It does do something. And I think the randomizing the struct does mean they do need to go through the process of figuring that out ahead of time. And this constify does prevent the write to those selected objects that actually get the mutable const attribute. So it does a little something, but odds are there's more that can be done within the entirety of the kernel. So it's like they're taking away a little bit, and there's still the rest of the world to focus on. It's just, it's not doing very much. Although, in fairness, it can mean that an exploit that is written just to target your standard Linux distribution just won't work here. Like, it won't have been written in a way to work or to be portable onto the GR security system. So, like, there is kind of the benefit when it comes to the mass exploitation of some of these bugs that could come up, but anything that gets targeted towards them, it's not really stopping. So, I mean, there is that benefit of the mass exploitation not being hit, because, I mean, script kiddies are a thing, but...
But that's pretty much all that will be stopped by the mitigation like this.
Yeah, and there is value to that. It's just not huge, I guess, in my mind.
Yeah, well, see, the way that it's framed, because it talks about like wanting to build off of that in the wild exploit targeting Android, those kinds of chains do tend to be more targeted. So framing it in this way, like, oh, we built this mitigation to stop scenarios like that, like, I don't think that's really where it would add any value. You know, it would be more on the mass exploitation, like you're saying. So, I don't think it's like completely useless, which is why I wanted to talk about it a little bit. But like you said, like it feels like a bit of an older style approach to mitigation.
Yeah, like I think time is better spent much earlier in the stage, but
yeah. All right, so we do have a few shoutouts before we wrap up the show. One of them is from Project Zero, actually, and it's analysis of an in-the-wild iOS Safari web content to GPU process exploit, post by Ian Beer. As per usual with these Project Zero posts, it's quite long, goes into quite a bit of detail. Didn't have quite enough time to really get into all the specifics of it, and there's quite a few like Apple-specific things, because it deals with the Safari IPC and being able to hit the GPU from Safari. So it's pretty specific to Apple's setup. So that's part of why we didn't want to cover it also. But if you are interested in like iOS and Apple, we wanted to throw this out there because it is a good resource to have. And there might be some information here that's relevant to you. And kind of in the same vein, there was also a GitHub Security Lab post from Manumo on a Chrome RCE through the maglev compiler. It's sort of similar in terms of area to the last GitHub Security Lab Chrome RCE that we covered, but it's a lot more involved because it's like a mid-tier JIT compiler, so it's not the typical turbo fan. It operates at a different like tier level. It's not as optimized and whatnot. Yeah, there's a lot of terminology in here that's would take some background reading to get up to speed on. And I'm not totally confident in our ability to cover it because it is so outside of even like the typical Chrome bugs that we cover. But again, if you're looking to do Chrome research, Manumo's posts in the past have been excellent. And I'm sure there's some information that's of value in here to you. So I'd still want to give it a shout out. But yeah, that's pretty much everything that we have for the week. So as always, thanks goes out to all of you for listening. If you want to go back and check out past episodes, you can find them on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more links on Anchor. Feel free to join Discord and follow us on Twitter. Links for those are down below in the description. And we'll see you next week.